Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Today, we're happy to be joined by Suzanne Antonetta. She's the author of the memoir, Make Me a Mother. Antonetta examines her own experience as the mother of an adopted son from South Korea, and in the process gives us a new definition of family, home, and love. In a country where 4% of us adopt, and celebrities make a sport of adopting children from overseas, Antonetta asks if it's possible to establish unconditional love and connection to a child who's not biologically yours. And as an adopted child grows up, how turbulent is the journey towards adulthood when questions of your own identity and self-worth loom so large?
Not only does Antonetta's story evoke biracial and cross-cultural experience, but it makes us question the shape and substance of our own families. What did her adopted son teach Antonetta about our own childhood and family background? Do we choose to adopt for the same reasons we choose to become pregnant? Her story is not only deeply reflective, but highly informative.
So, Suzanne, welcome to my show. I loved your book, and I really appreciate a lot of the brave transparency which you put out there.
Thank you.
So I want to start out with the question, why do people adopt, and why did you adopt?
You know, that's one of the most fundamental questions, and I think also one of the hardest ones to answer. I do want to say, before I tell my story, that I think there's a misperception that adoption is always what you do if things don't work out some other way. And it's important to remember that many of us are preferential adopters. We adopt because that's how we imagine forming a family. And it's certainly, you know, the majority of infertile couples do not go on to adopt. So adoption for me was always in my heart. I grew up in a very large family with 20-some-odd cousins, and I was the older one on both sides. So I babysat for all kinds of kids, lots of kids in my life. I was just aware of how much you really can just fall in love with a kid. They're fantastic little beings. And I was also aware that a lot of kids need parents, and it just made sense to me. I'm not presenting it as an altruistic thing to do, because it certainly isn't. It's simply the way I saw myself forming a family. I did imagine I'd have biological kids too, and that didn't happen, but I knew I wanted to adopt.
Are there wrong and right reasons for adoption? I mean, everything is broken down in my world to moral hedonism or hedonism. We're always driven by pleasure. It's either pleasure because it gives us a good feeling, and there's also a moral component, or it just gives us a good feeling. So what are the right reasons to adopt, and what are the wrong ones?
I think the right reasons to adopt are the right reasons to have any child. You really want a child. You want that relationship. That relationship's going to be primary for you. And I think it also needs to be part of the process that you realize there's another kinship network in this child's life. And in some sense or another, you're going to fold that in, even if it's just that you always acknowledge they're there. Not all kids can have reunions with birth parents or would want to, but you do have to be aware that that's there. I think the wrong reasons are the same as the wrong reasons for having a kid. You're having a kid because you think your parents want you to, or it's what people do, or it's kind of a status symbol, but you don't really intend to make that relationship primary. That's bad.
I was going to ask you about the mother instinct. I mean, there was a lot written about that in feminism back in the day. The idea that women just are more nurturing and they have a hunger for children.
Do I agree with that?
Whether it factored in at all in your decision to adopt.
I knew I wanted to be a mother, but my husband knew he wanted to be a father. I think that we kind of isolate that feeling to women when it's really very human and, you know, really very creature-wide, that love of nurture. Birds will take in, you know, the birds of other birds simply because they want to. They'll you know, if a nest gets abandoned, they'll hatch the eggs. I think that connection is so rich and so powerful when you are able to nurture it yourself, because it needs to be nurtured. We know that. We know a lot of kids aren't well taken care of.
Mm-hmm. But some people don't have that nurturing instinct, women or men.
Yeah, they either don't have it or they've been really damaged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I always think about is that there is the need to nurture, and there's the instinctual need to, evolutionary need to just keep the species going. But why is there not the need to mentor? Nurturing without mentoring ends up having kids at the end of the day that don't really appreciate anyone, including the people who nurture them.
Well, I think that's a beautiful distinction to make between nurturing and mentoring. And what you see a lot in foster care, which is a really overburdened and sad thing right now, is that people often get very into the idea of having babies, but they really get sort of turned off when the kids get some free will. You know, like so you see kids coming in the system more around 5, 6 years old rather than at birth. Because I think the nurturing instinct is there, but when they're older, what you're doing is more mentoring, and that's a lot harder, I think, in many ways.
Yeah, I think that's what they're not doing. I think what they're doing is they're trying, like most parents, and not all, but most want to recreate the child in their image. They care what the parents think. They care how they're doing in relationship to the class. And the last thing they're doing is figuring out who the kid is.
Yes, and I think that's a really critical distinction, and one of the wrong reasons for being a parent is that somehow you feel as if there's a life plan that maybe you didn't manage to achieve, or you simply have as an ideal, and that the child will follow that life plan for you. And one of the people I quote in my book is a psychiatrist named James Lieberman, who said, if you can't psychologically imagine yourself adopting, you're not ready to be a parent of anybody. And he didn't mean you should adopt. That wasn't at all the point. The point was, if you can't imagine your child is a separate individual, really, really different from you, has their own path, then you're really not ready to be a parent. You're kind of caught up in your own ego if you can't accept that.
Can I just ask you something? This is totally off the wall, but when I first read your book, I thought, wow, this is a case of over-mothering, if I've ever read it in my life. But then, afterwards, I did some research on adoptees and their issues and problems. And instinctually, you addressed every single one of these issues. And I wondered if you had done any research beforehand, or whether it was just impulsive and you knew.
Well, I think that, first of all, the research on adoptees and what they need and problems, I think, has to be qualified, because most of that research is really, really shoddy. I did do a lot of that research, and I was shocked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, one of the most important theorists of adoption, Marshall Schechter, his cohort group, the only folks he included in his research, were 16 of his own patients.
Yes.
That's meaningless. So I will say, though, that because, it's just like, okay, my son came into my life, he was a few months old. I know parents who had children born with serious health problems who were in isolettes for the first few months.
Mm-hmm.
You have to catch up on that bonding, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Does it look a little crazed? Yes, it does.
Yeah.
It does look a little crazed, I imagine.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think it's, yeah.
No, I was just saying, all the supermom activities that went on when Jin first came into your life. I thought, my gosh, if I'd done that with my own daughter, I'd be half dead. You know, I wouldn't have been able to do anything else. On the other hand, you were addressing some really powerful issues, like that very, very basic sense of loss and abandonment that even babies feel when they're adopted, apparently.
I don't think they do, and I have read all the studies that argue that, and the science is just very poor.
Mm-hmm.
I'll kind of leave it at that. I think that, you know, they do experience a different kind of early life because of that transition, But a lot of kids, like I said, spend the first few months of their lives in a NICU, a newborn, you know, intensive care, or for one reason or another, postpartum depression is a really common reason for babies to have to be primarily nurtured by someone other than the mother. And there really is not a big long-term impact to that. And it does look very much the same with adoption that it looks with, you know, any child for whom that those first few months maybe that child is not that close to the mother. My own father, his mother was so ill when he was born that he was actually wet nursed by another woman. So this is not unusual, and it is not the sort of big loss, primal wound thing. Mm-hmm. The problem with adoption research is they've put groups together of kids born to addicted moms, not adopted till they were 5, 6, 7 years old, real stress in the early life, together with, you know, adopted child research simply has never taken into account the child's earliest environment.
I find that to be very, very true in my own practice. Now, I want to ask you about something because it was interesting. As a child, you mentioned in the book that you had a fantasy about being adopted, correct?
I did.
I had a fantasy that my parents were dropped off by aliens and I was stuck with them. But so tell me why you had that fantasy. That's kind of interesting.
It's actually very common. Most children go through that. Mine is a little more long-term and kind of strong than many kids are. But my parents and I are just very, very, very different. They're both very mathematical and very concrete and very practical. And I've always been a D student in math, never could do it. Really impractical, kind of the classic flighty, creative type. And it just didn't seem to me as if there could be this genetic bond with them. So I just kind of imagined that they'd adopted me and just failed to tell me. And someone out there was somebody more like me than they were. I mean, it's not a criticism of them.
No. Actually, it's a great story, because what you're really saying, and it goes back to my point. My point is that your parents did not, in my estimation, parent you, find out who you are, deal with you on your level. There's a verse in the scripture that says parents are to lay up for the children and children not for the parents, which basically means it's the job of the parent to take care of the kid, not the kid to take care of the parent. Maybe later on it's a different discussion, but we'll address that then. So
yes.
I know you don't want to be critical, but don't you feel in some way that they failed to reach you on your level?
Yes, but I don't think they were ever given the tools to do that. And, you know, the title, Make Me a Mother, has to do with the fact that Jin made me a mother as much as I made him my son. I really felt like I was just given the child that was the child to turn me into the best parent I could be. And I think, sadly, for my own parents, they were given a child with whom they were destined to really struggle. And one of the things that, you know, I've thought about a lot as an adoptive mom is just how much right now we believe in genes. We just feel like if you share DNA, that's kind of all you need. And I think genetics have become a little bit of an almost fetish for us, something that we just believe in unquestioningly, the way we used to believe in Freud's ideas.
I not only agree with you, but I want you to hear what you just said before. You said they didn't have the tools. Your parents obviously were quite bright. When you want to plant the garden, you go to Home Depot. They could have gotten the tools, right?
Sure.
Like, why let them off the hook?
Well, I'm leaving them off the hook partly because, and I think this book is a real act of meditation on that, of giving that up, that feeling that they didn't do right by me. And, you know, there are obviously some big issues there, one of which is sexual abuse, but not by my parents, I want to qualify that, but something that happened to me that I knew I couldn't tell them, which, because I knew that they would have blamed me for it. And I think that's, you know, now that I'm a parent, that's a pretty huge thing to lay on a kid. But I will say that I think that having my own son go through the teenage years, he's going to turn 17 now in a few weeks, has really made me very aware of just how hard this is. And moments where, you know, I kind of felt like, oh, I can see how you could give up.
Well, you know,
I'm not going to give up, but I could see how you could give up. This is really hard.
That literature that you question, and I question it too now that I've heard what you've said, they all say that adoptees have the most trouble during adolescence, that that's when the importance of belonging, the problem of being different, the problem of autonomy and identity, and so forth, all becomes evident.
And I think that's true.
And I think the way that you handled it was really admirable. It's quite interesting. And especially...
I'm sorry, Betsy, go ahead.
No, I thought the way that you handled Jin's adolescence was very wise.
Well, you know, it doesn't feel wise to me. I feel like I just bumble and stumble along every day. So thank you. That's beautiful to hear.
Well, motherhood is as you point out, it's a continual act of creation. And it evolves, as you say.
Absolutely. And it's a continual act of choice. I'm going to be the best person I can be for this child today.
But you have the right attitude. See, the bottom line is it's not all about you. It's about how you could be the best mother for Jin. Now, most kids are inherently narcissistic. Their frontal lobe's not really fully wired to 25. So everything is all about them.
Oh, absolutely.
And you know, they'll find any reason to blame their parents for anything, right
or
wrong. But what I'm hearing from you is that you rack your head how to do the right thing as opposed to how to control the child.
I do rack my head for how to do the right thing, and I fail at it every day. I say that in the book over and over again. I think there are some things we've done well. I think one of them is creating community within, you know, the Korean community in my town and with the country. You know, I think we've had good success with making Jin feel completely part of that. And Betsy, to go back to your comment, I think absolutely the adoptive stuff comes out more in adolescence because mm-hmm. of the identity issues and because kids start separating themselves by race.
Yeah.
They just, in my experience, did not do that until later middle school, and then they start doing it. And so you have to be really prepared for that. It's that can be difficult.
Well, it's that huge issue that all adolescents face is being part of the group and belonging.
Sure.
And you don't
sure.
want to be different.
No.
It's a stage, that's all.
Yes, and you have to swallow some things. Like, you know, it's harder for Jin to be seen with me now because immediately his story is clear. You know, I look very Southern Italian / you know, sort of ethnic. And he's Korean, and we're just obviously, as soon as somebody that he knows casually sees us together, they know his story.
Except that you live in New York City, because in New York City, he could be your husband or your boyfriend.
I know. That's hilarious. It's so true. When we're in a city, it's really different. But, in our town, it's, you know, it's pretty transparent what's going on. So that's hard for him, and it's hard for me to feel like, oh, he doesn't want to be seen with me. But, you know, I will say also just to keep this kind of balance with adoption, because I feel like, you know, there's 40% of the population or 30%, something like that. It's a high number of people have considered adoption, but I think they get that negativity and they don't consider it. So I would just put out there that, you know, children of divorce have more problems, actually, than adopted children, and those tend to hit in adolescence as well for kind of similar reasons of identity and role models and things like that.
I would go further than that. I mean, I've been married for 40-some years.
And she's only 47.
Yeah. Anyway, I have an only child. And mm-hmm. adolescents presented some of the same issues that you have mentioned. I mean, my daughter wanted to be autonomous. She didn't want to be seen with me. She wanted to distinguish herself. She wanted to be part of the group and not with this crazy mother, you know, who had lived in a hippie commune. I mean, she just wanted to be herself. And I think that's just a typical adolescent issue. And it seems to me that a lot of this adoptive literature has pathologized adoptees, yes. Don't you?
Yes, I think so. And I think that, you know, it's sometimes as a culture we have a huge tendency to pathologize. You know, when I was in grade school, I had such attention problems that the kid behind me, his job was to poke me in the back with a pencil.
I think that was me.
Did you grow up in New Jersey? It might have been.
No.
So I keep joking, this was 60s Ritalin, you know, the pencil poking me in the shoulder. I just have so many friends whose kids I strongly feel, you know, are being, they're on all this medication, they have all these diagnoses, and in many cases you look and you see either it's kind of normal kid acting out because that's what they do, or they're just not quite as good a student as the parent wants them to be, or sometimes there's a family problem. But nobody really addresses that anymore.
Or sometimes the parent doesn't know what to do with the child. So, for instance,
sure.
When a child has severe ADD, what works for them is to play a lot of sports, and
yes.
the activity of running and using your body actually helps significantly with ADD. It's simply a lack of knowledge. But I want to go back to something I said jokingly, but I mean very seriously. I am not a great fan of adoption if you're putting your child in a arena where they're going to be perceived as different. Meaning, mm-hmm. if you're living in a large city, and when you go out to play, your friends are, like I grew up in Brooklyn. My friends were Black, Hispanic, gay, straight, from every single walk of life, and nobody was different. I mean, everybody was different, but no one was different because everyone was different.
Yeah, me too. I grew up in northern New Jersey, and I had that experience as well. Yes, we're very aware of where we live. I mean, we're on the Pacific Rim. We're 20 miles from the border with British Columbia, which is actually more ethnic Chinese than it is Caucasian. And even in my town, there's not only a large Asian population, but there's a great number of adopted kids. Adoption tends to cluster. So, like down the street, you know, across the street, down the street the other way, tons of adopted kids. So one of the conversations my husband and I had, because we're academics, and academics tend to move a lot, you know, they tend to kind of often trade up every 5 or 6 years in their job because it's the only way to really get substantial increases in salary. We had a conversation before we adopted. Okay, you know what? We can't move. We can move somewhere that's more diverse, but we can't move anywhere that's less diverse. And that actually wipes out most of the university towns in the United States. So we were very, very aware of that environmental need, that not only being Asian not be, you know, strange, but being adopted not be strange.
This is just a hypothetical, but is being mm-hmm. different really that onerous? Is that really so injurious to children?
Well, I just think it's tough when they're adolescents, and I think it's still not necessarily injurious, but
I mean, it can make a person a lot stronger, develop inner resources.
Yeah.
And become deeper human beings. I mean, I'm just throwing that out as a hypothetical.
See, Bessie, I actually agree with you, because what happens is, and Suzanne, I want your input on this, what happens is that every child is searching for an identity that they could be proud of, and there's not mm-hmm. cognitive dissonance. What they want, how they perceive themselves is not different from how they act.
Yes.
So
mm-hmm.
if being different, okay, you could own it and be proud of it, then that, in fact, ends up making you a lot stronger as a person. What do you think, Sue?
I think that's absolutely true. I completely agree with both of you. I think that we sort of overstress ease, don't we, and being comfortable. And life is not comfortable. And I think that if you work through difficult stuff, you become your best self. And that was actually one of the lessons of Sigmund Freud that I really loved, that I think we've kind of forgotten. He wasn't just saying, you know, people can be neurotic, they can be hysterical, they can have bad moms, but he was saying, work through that And you're the best human being you can be.
You know, Peter. And, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, and I was going to say, I think that's just a really powerful message that we've kind of lost.
Peter Kramer has a wonderful definition of mental health, and he calls it the differentiation of self in the face of communal pressure. So,
yes, that's beautiful.
So that's maturity for you. And maybe being a misfit, maybe being a little different is a plus. It's a negative,
yes.
Obviously, going through these dreadful adolescent times. But in the end,
yes.
This is going to make him a deeper, more multifaceted and empathic human being.
Yes, and I've worked with a lot of adult adoptees since I teach at a university. And they do perceive their lives, you know, if all has gone well, and of course in everybody's life things don't always go well, but as very rich, you know, having these many cultures, many family groups, even if they're not family groups they're directly connected to, just that sense of kind of richness, lots of connections in their lives and lots of pieces
yeah.
in their lives.
So before I go to my next question, my favorite quote from Freud was, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
And that's true, too.
So the next question is, tell me about the man in your life. Tell me about Bruce and how he handled all this and, you know, about your relationship with him.
Oh, well, you know, I'm kind of like Betsy. I've been married 32 years, so we're lifers. We got married pretty young. 12, actually, you know, one of those permissive southern states. Don't make any inferences about my age here. Yeah, he is amazing. And he's not, he's in the book, but probably certainly not as big a character as Jin. And he doesn't really want to be a huge character in my book. But we've been together since we were in college. And he's amazing. And he's, I think in a lot of ways, a bit more calm and grounded than I am. So where I'm kind of, you know, sometimes overthinking things, he'll often be able to just kind of calm me down.
Tell me about his relationship with Jin. I mean, how does
they're
Jin...
They're very, very close.
They are.
They're very close, yeah. They have a wonderful relationship. We all do.
Gang up on you?
Oh, they gang up on me constantly. Yeah. They definitely do. I will say that when Jin was a baby, Bruce was even more hysterical about things than I am. And he had this, you know, we had a Merck medical manual, which was a dangerous thing at the time, because something very normal would happen to Jin, and Bruce would go to it, and he would come up with the weirdest diagnosis ever. Like, the first time he had an ear infection, he diagnosed him with nocturnal seizure disorder. And so we would actually go to the emergency room, you know how you do that with infants, with the screaming kid, and he'd be like, doctor, I know what it is. It's nocturnal seizure disorder. And I really think somewhere at our local ER, there's a picture of him that's kind of a wanted poster.
That's wonderful.
Do not allow into the exam room. It was so funny.
Well, you know, part of the pop literature that you're not going to like is that it's really harder to adopt a male baby, because they're always going to have that yearning for the birth father. You don't mention that in the book. You talk more about birth mother and his interest in the birth mother.
I'm following Jin's lead in that. He does not ever talk about his birth father, although we talk about both of them. It's always been his birth mother that he's been kind of oriented towards wanting to find or meet. And actually, that was really powerful in him in middle school, but fell off a bit in high school. Right now, he's not sure. He could search in a year, but he's not sure he wants to, which I think is just the fact that when you're a teenager, your immediate life is right in front of you, and that's all you really think about.
So, Suzanne, the other thing is the fact that you're okay with it makes him less needed to search. If you say, you know what, it's a great idea, anything you need, I'll help you, he's not going to search.
Yeah, and we've always been more than okay with it. And it's one of those things that before Jin came, I thought this would really threaten me, you know. This scares me that there's this other mom out there. But I, you know, to me, she's family. I mean, I just had a piece in Parade magazine on Mother's Day about how, to us, she's family. And I would love to meet her, and I would love for Jin to know her. I think, you know, the heart isn't a limited organ. You can love so many people, and you never love any two of them in the same way. And that's one of the messages of the book, is that, you know, you can just keep adding. There isn't a limit that you don't get. It's not like a deli where you get a ticket. You only get a certain number of items.
You are a very special person, Suzanne. I mean, I want you to know that. You're a very special person. And
thank you.
You know, and people who hear this around the country and the world should adopt your heart.
You know what? We have a terrible problem in this country. We've got 250,000 kids in foster care. And those adoptions are, you know, people are afraid of the cost. There's generally no cost or very low cost. And we really need to start stepping up our game. I'm donating some of the proceeds of this book, and I'm hoping that others will just start advocating for homes for kids.
Yeah. I'm so amazed by the way you opened yourself to Korean culture. I think that was enriching for you, but it was so important for Jin. It's amazing what you did.
Yeah.
Especially that first birthday party and the food and everything. Just extraordinary to me.
Yeah, and we've now been to Korea twice. We actually went last summer. And when we go for a fairly substantial amount of time so we can really kind of sink into it. And we got this special permission for him to do Korean as his language. So he's doing it through Rosetta Stone, but he's getting credit for it. So he's actually now able to talk a fair bit in Korean, which is great. You know, it started out certainly as something we felt we needed to do for Jin's sake, but it has been one of the hugest blessings of adoption. Now my life is enriched.
Yeah.
Korean friends, the country, it's all part of my life now.
Absolutely. Well, why did you, by the way, choose Korea? Were you actually choosing the country?
Well, you know, going back to what Betsy was saying, no, we weren't. We started out domestic, and that didn't work. China, and that didn't work. And then our social worker called us, and he said, you know what, I have waiting boys in Korea. There aren't enough parents for these boys, because I think people get that message about boys. Most international adoptive parents choose girls. It's like 70-80% list a preference for girls or only girls. So, you know, at some stages, boys have been special needs simply because they're male. So, no, and I have to say that when we switched our file to Korea and said, yes, you know, send us waiting boys, we were mildly terrified because it was the one place we didn't have a strong connection to as a country. But we developed that, and as I said, it's a gift. I love the country. I love the people. I feel like Korea and Italy have so much in common that it's like home in some ways. You know, it's very high touch. It's very physical. They love food. So actually, that's just been fantastic. We've made a lot of wonderful friends we wouldn't have made without Jin.
We used to have some very, very good friends. They both died, but they adopted two girls from Korea. Mm-hmm. And the way those girls transform their lives is just absolutely amazing.
It is.
I mean, their horizons expanded in ways you can't imagine. Even in religion, and I wanted to ask you about that aspect of Jin's development.
We did join a Korean church. We went there as long as it existed. It was very small, and it kind of fell apart, but we went there for about 4 years, and it was really something, because Korean services are really long. They last a few hours, and then you eat. Everybody brings food, and then you eat for a few hours. So it was, you know, 4 hours every Sunday, and very few people who attended, very few adults spoke any English. And as hard as Bruce and I have tried to learn Korean, we couldn't do more than stumble through a little Korean. So, you know, for years we worshipped and ate every Sunday with folks we couldn't really communicate with. The kids, you know, Jin had, there are lots and lots of kids at the church, and so he had friends and they spoke English. But it was a real object lesson in how close you can be with people, how much you can become family without sharing a language. really humbling and fantastic.
Yeah.
So define for me, by the way, what is a family?
I think a family, you know, I come back to the root of the word adoption, which means to take by choice, if you go back to the Latin root. And I think family is the people that we've taken by choice into our lives. And I think that that can certainly include all your biological relatives, because I think...
Or not.
Absolutely. Sometimes they're toxic and they shouldn't be in your life. But if they remain in your life, I think it's because you've actively chosen to continue to have a relationship. I think when we don't choose relationships, no matter what they are, they die.
Well, I think it's the same with motherhood, too, don't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You choose it every day. You know, the law is always going to recognize you as mother and child, but for the emotional part of it to work, you have to keep choosing it. And I have friends I consider totally family, neighbors I consider family. I think it's the kinship network you create, and that's especially true in the United States, where we're not born somewhere where we're going to stay necessarily for the rest of our lives into a career path that's already set out for us.
So do you think that, meaning you're such a loving person, do you think that you could possibly or would possibly love your child more if he came from your womb?
I do not. I think if I loved my child any more than I do, I would be a little helpless puddle on the floor. I mean, I absolutely know I love him to the utmost, more than I ever imagined I could love. So I think if I had had a biological child, I would love that child just as much. I think every love you have is different.
I believe in multiple mothers anyway. I grew up in the South, and most of my friends, now this is back in the day, had African-American nannies who were with them almost as much as their real mothers.
Interesting.
And I feel personally that I didn't have one mother. I had many mothers, and this was at a very early age, and that continued throughout life, choosing mentors, choosing people who nurtured me in really positive ways. So maybe it takes a village is right. You need multiple mothers and fathers.
You do, and I think we've really lost that realization to our great detriment. And it's interesting how many cultures have kind of a mythology of that. Like in China, they believe there's an invisible red thread. I don't know why it's red if it's invisible. Mm-hmm. That ties you to people who are meant to be in your life. And one of the people I quote in my book is a Liberian writer who told me once that they believe you're born to a number of mothers and fathers. You're only physically born to one of each, but in the spirit world, you're born to many. And they're meant to be in your life, and they will be in your life. So I think a lot of cultures have acknowledged that with, you know, a really profound mythology, and we kind of lost it.
Talk to me more about the difficulty of adolescence right now that you're going through with your son.
Well, you know, we're not having a lot of difficulty right now, I have to say. 15 was a little bit of a turning point. Before 15, he got into that kind of occasional just having outbursts, being angry, that kind of thing. And it was definitely very normal, but it was really hard for us because we'd always been really close. And, you know, all of a sudden that, get out of my room, or, you know, you're embarrassing me, you always embarrass me, that kind of adolescent stuff was a bit painful. But you know, I think if you can kind of find a calm place and put yourself into your child's experience, you start understanding that it's really not about you. But one of the stories I tell in the book is when Jin was, I think, 14, and we got into this big argument, and we were staying in a motel room, and he got up and he locked himself in the closet, and he said, I'm going to sleep in here. And we just heard this crashing while he tried to position himself in the closet. because of course he couldn't. And I thought it was such a great metaphor, you know.
I love the card he made you.
Yeah, he was in a room that was too small for his growing body, and he needed to move on, but he just, none of us really quite knew how to let him move on yet.
That's a beautiful metaphor.
It is. It is.
Tell about the card that he made for you. I think that was one of the most moving parts of your book.
He's made a bunch of cards. Do you mean the one where the middle finger
popped out of it?
Yes. Yeah, for Mother's Day when he was 15, he made it. Because he actually just made this year's Mother's Day card, which is my face. Uh-huh. Superimposed on the Mona Lisa.
I love it.
Fantastic. But that one was a pop-up card he made, and it said, roses are red, violets are blue, happy Mother's Day, and you open it up, so F you, and this middle finger popped up. But it was, you know, it had hearts, and I mean, it was really so sweet in that teenage way where they can't, you know, they can't say the sweet thing. And I think sometimes even the arguing with you is it's a way of engaging with you emotionally when they just don't quite know how else to do that.
You know what? It is what teenagers are all about. It's like, I really do love you and I hate you at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's it is definitely part of what it is all about. I was fascinated by what you said about the ancient Romans often abandon or swap their children frequently.
They did, yes.
Now, what was that all about, you know?
Well, it varied.
I tried to swap my parents. But
I know. It's really wild. But, you know, a Roman father had complete control over his family for life. I mean, they could kill their children if they wanted to, pretty much at any time. And it was very common when children were born, they were presented to the father, and he decided what to do. And they frequently did what they called exposing, which for a long time we thought meant, you know, leaving out to die, but we now realize meant more putting out for possible adoption. Sometimes the children were picked up and used as slaves, sometimes even put in brothels if they were girls. But they were also adopted. And that was often a matter of, you know, whether they felt they could care for the child, much like, you know, our adoption is. And but the upper classes also swapped kids and adopted kids out really frequently to build family ties, kind of the way people sometimes marry to create family ties. They used adoption to create family ties within powerful families.
Are there any other cultures that do that? Because that's actually, I never knew that at any time a father could kill his child. And that's kind of fascinating. Is there any other culture where that comes from?
That idea of that paterfamilias, the father of the family.
Yes.
I don't know any other where the father had that kind of power to kill or, you know, take the child's income. I mean, they really had an enormous amount of control. So what you see in Rome in their texts was a certain amount of litigation over fathers who wanted children back that they had put out, you know, for exposure. If those children were adopted by someone who gave them, let's say, some real trade skills, some very usable skills, or made them heirs and the children became wealthy, the parents, or even well off, the bio parents would sue to get them back. And so there are court cases of, you know, just like our court cases where biological parents are suing to get often adult children back because they represent maybe some income.
This isn't exactly the same, but the tradition throughout medieval and Renaissance Europe was that aristocratic girls were sent away from home at a very early age, maybe six, to another aristocratic family to be raised.
Yes, that's incredibly common. The Hawaiian royal families all were, the children were always adopted out, particularly the ones who were bound to rule. And that was a way of creating ties among clans that were important.
Interesting.
I think, yes, and in the Middle Ages in England, they also, I mean, this is all through Beowulf. Beowulf, the poem, is full of references to adoption. they would always adopt out the children, the boys, because they felt like they would get better training and more discipline in another house.
Right.
So they were fostered out, and again, at a pretty young age, and, you know, often wouldn't see their parents again for 6, 7, 8, 10 years.
Suzanne, I'm wondering, do you believe that children, as they get older, have a moral obligation to care for their parents?
Oh, because I'm caring for mine? Not necessarily, no, I don't. I think I have a moral obligation to help my parents, and I think that our relationship has really rebuilt and become rich and deep as they've gotten older, in ways I would never have predicted and they wouldn't have predicted. But I don't think there's any absolute obligation to care for anyone. It really depends.
Interesting. You have been a more than fascinating guest, and I just really thank you for taking the time doing the program. You were great.
Thank you. You guys asked the best questions. You made my job very easy.
Well, you've written a beautiful book. And
thank
I can
you, Betsy.
And I understood right away that you were a poet on page one.
Thank you. That's
again, I just love your heart. I apologize for poking you with the pencil. but you needed it, okay?
I needed it. It was fine. Probably better than being put on speed, right?
I was just flirting, that's all. You have a wonderful day.
Yeah.
You too. Thank you both
wonderful.
So much.
Thank you.
I want to once again thank from the bottom of my heart Suzanne Antonetta for appearing on a show. Pick up a copy of her book, Make Me a Mother. It's in bookstores today. It's published by Norton. Also, visit our website at suzannepaila.com. Betsy, the thing that I enjoyed the most about the show was just the fact that she didn't even know how good of a person she was. I mean, this woman has a heart to love. She is the furthest thing from a narcissist. And that's what actually struck me, that she wasn't bitching and moaning about how hard it was as much of how much of a privilege it is to create a larger family. And I was impressed.
I think she's a real super mom. And part of that, I think, and she even mentions this in her book, is that she was trying to compensate in some ways for a lack of mothering that she experienced as a child. She is a great nurturer. I mean, there's no question
about that.
I mean, I've never read anything like the stories of the way that she endured his terrible twos or that adolescent episode. I mean, those were rough times for her, and she tells it like it is. But at the same time, she doesn't, I don't think, realize how many women really, and men, don't give a damn about children and how they're doing and whether they're helping them properly through the terrible twos or whatever. So I was very, very impressed, as you were too, that she has, as they say in music, she's taken motherhood to the bridge.
I mean,
what a challenge.
She's amazing. You know, it always marvels me, Betsy. You need a license to cut hair.
Yes. Okay.
You need a license to do most anything, do nails, whatever. But you don't need a license for being a parent.
Which is the most important thing.
Exactly. Meaning we have it all backwards. Having a child doesn't make you a parent.
No. Okay? But you read People magazine and you see Angelina with this tribe of adopted children and you think, how cool. This could be fun. But I think what this book drives home is that it's not just fun. It's a tremendous amount of work, tremendous amount of intuition involved, a lot of really high-powered nurturing and understanding and empathy. I mean, it's an extraordinary job, as you say.
It's an extraordinary job and an extraordinary book. I have a plug for Angelina Jolie. Okay. One is I honestly think that she did an amazing thing because those children have an identity of being her child. And they're going to, it's like this is a world famous, one of the number one known movie stars in the world, and they chose me. So I don't think it was all about her. I actually think that she is an amazing person.
Oh, I agree. I think she's a fabulous role model. I'm just saying that for people.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to let you know. And, and Angelina, you are going to come on our show, right? Okay, whatever. Yes, I am. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, and Betsy and I both want you to remember, to every single problem, there is a solution. I am your problem solver. Now, you're going to want to, not have to, but you're going to want to check out our other episodes on gluckradio.com. There is something for everyone. You tweet your friends, make them listen to these amazing episodes. And you have nothing to do in the afternoon. So do something that's going to really enrich your life. Buy Betsy Prelow's books on the art of seduction. They're on Amazon.com. They're entitled Seductress and Swoon. Swoon is published by Norton, the other book by Penguin. Keep listening and keep sending us your feedback. Till next time.